Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
Today we spend the hour on food politics, the good food revolution, and the movements to build equitable and sustainable food systems.
But first, why do people remain in refugee camps for decades? Refugees remain in camps for an average of 17 years, and often for much, much longer, according to our next guest. Elizabeth Dunn is a professor of geography at Indiana University, and she explored this phenomenon for her book,
No Path Home. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you, Elizabeth Dunn. This book is extraordinary. I can't believe you spent 16 months in refugee camps. How did you decide to do this? And how did you decide how to do this?
I don't think anybody chooses to go to a refugee camp. I think that it's one of those things that happen to you like it happens to the people who live there. And I actually had a Fulbright scholarship to go to Georgia. And before this, I was a scholar of food and agriculture. And I was working with apple farmers in a region called South Ossetia, which was then a province of the Republic of Georgia. And I had come to learn Georgian. I'd come to Indiana University to learn Georgian, and I had, rented my house. I'd sold my car. I had my five-year-old with me. We're literally driving to the airport when I get a call from the State Department saying, don't get on the plane. The Russians have invaded. They have bombed the airport.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was quite shocking. So I ended up turning back to Colorado and teaching for a semester, and that was August the 8th. 2008. And so by the time I arrived on New Year's Day or thereabouts in 2009, there were 36,000 people who had been more or less permanently displaced. The number of permanently displaced ended up to be about 30,000 people. And the Georgian government had started building these little settlements for them. They called them settlements because in distinction to an earlier population of displaced people who had lived for 17 years in old in-tourist hotels, the government was telling the people who had been displaced in 2008 that this was likely to be a permanent condition. And so had moved them into these, they really feel like camps. They called them settlements, but they feel like camps. So row after row after row of little white cinder block houses that looked, for all intents and purposes, like every refugee camp you've ever seen.
You noted in the introduction of the book, which is called No Path Home, that there were something like, by 2016, 65 million people forced from their homes. Now, if people think about this, the population of California is 39 million people. We're talking about 65 million people by 2016. I assume that number has grown.
This is not a problem that is going away. It is a problem that is going to be exacerbated by climate change, by conflicts, now that there is like no bipolar stabilization from the Cold War, now that the U.S. does not act effectively as a hegemon, we are going to see flare-ups of these little wars all over the world. And the upshot is that the number of displaced people around the world is just escalating dramatically. When I started the research for this book in 2009, there were 35 million displaced people, and we've almost doubled that number in under a decade. So this is a huge ongoing problem. And while the Syrians, of course, have gotten all the attention because of their flight towards Europe, the truth is that 2/3 of the displaced people in the world never leave their countries of origin. They're internally displaced people, and they're getting no attention. They're getting very little help. And I think that their situation will become more dire.
You described this in your book as having a protection gap. There's a protection gap between the internally displaced and the people who are external refugees. What exactly is this?
Well, I think the question of who is supposed to protect internally displaced people is an open question. Internally displaced people do not formally fall under the United Nations mandate under the 1951 Convention on Refugees, although they've been called persons of interest to the High Commission on Refugees. So the upshot is that they are still the responsibility of the government of their country of origin. And the problem is that many, many times, that is the government that forced them from their homes. So we're leaving them at the mercy. I mean, the responsibility to protect them is given to the people who were their aggressors. That's a really big protection gap. I mean, with the Rohingya, who are nominally the responsibility of the Burmese government, they are Burmese citizens. Burma decided they don't count as Burmese citizens and forcing them across the border into Bangladesh. So can we really say that this is the protecting these people should be the business of the Burmese government? I mean, that makes no sense at all. So nobody protects these people in many cases. There is no protection for them at all.
You also noted that they end up staying in these camps for decades sometimes, at least a decade and a half in many instances.
Yeah, once a person enters a camp, and today it's less than half the people who are displaced will go to a camp. And we talk about why they are refusing to enter camps. But once a person enters a camp, the average length of stay is 17 years. And the record length of stay is over 70 years.
Wow.
That's Palestinians. So that's now almost three generations born in what is supposed to be a temporary situation. So thinking of displacement as a temporary condition and providing temporary emergency aid, like a tent, for example, is crazy. This is not a temporary condition. It is a permanent condition of statelessness or quasi-statelessness.
Now, you also wrote about what actually happens to people in these conditions. And, you know, some of it is, the way you described it is, yes, they're still alive, their hearts are beating, their lungs are breathing, but they're not really living. And there's two kind of senses going on in terms of security and in terms of being part of a community. All of that is destroyed. How would you help us understand that?
Yeah, I think that the problem of forced migration has been thought of in two ways, usually. One is legally. What are these people's legal rights in their country of origin? What are their rights if they are forced out of their country of origin? Do they have any rights to migrate to another country? And the second way, and I think the much more frequent way that displacement is thought of, is as a problem of material goods, as a logistics problem, right? So the problem is to replace all the cots and pots and beds and pans that they had before. And once they get some replacement for those things, then their problem is solved. And I don't think that that's the real, that either of these are the real problem of displacement. The real problem of displacement is what I think of as an ontological one or an existential one, which is to say that, you know, most of us go through the world being fairly able to predict what's going to happen from day to day. And the things in our world are connected to each other in ways that make sense. I mean, you know, on a given, when you walk into your house, what your house is going to look like. You know where food is coming from. You know if you walk into a bureaucrat's office, more or less what's likely to happen. So it's not perfectly predictable, but our lives are fairly predictable. And for a displaced person, especially in the initial years, several years of displacement, the world makes no sense at all, right? Everything in their world has been literally blown apart. And that means all the relationships among things have been blown apart. And all of a sudden, this whole reign of new ideas, new terms, new things, new people are coming in that are brought in by the humanitarian project. And it's a profoundly disorienting process. And I have spent time with displaced people in the Republic of Georgia, where I did fieldwork. I also am on the board of a resettlement agency here in Indiana. And I take people up at the airport when they're first arriving. And it's amazing that it's the same experience, whether they're from Congo or Syria or Georgia, which is that they're stunned into speechlessness, sometimes for weeks. I mean, that they literally will sit there with blank, expressionless faces, saying nothing for hours, because the whole world has gone haywire. The whole world has been fragmented for them. And so my book is really about how people negotiate that experience of fragmentation. And while being trapped in this state of being permanently temporary, try to make a stable and meaningful world around themselves.
The other part that your book is about how humanitarian aid workers and organizations are really well-meaning, but there's this problem of perpetuation of people in these camps and not giving whatever it is they need to be able to reestablish themselves in a community.
Yeah. And so the book makes a very strong argument, which is that humanitarian aid not only does not help displaced people deal with the enormous existential disorientation of displacement, but actually works against them creating stable and meaningful lives for themselves. That's a pretty strong accusation, actually. And many humanitarians I have made this argument to are really upset about it. Needless to say, but I'll tell you, there's a couple of reasons why this happens. One is that humanitarian aid, because of the way it's organized, which is to say not very well organized, really creates an enormous amount of inconsistency and uncertainty. So in a given humanitarian emergency, the one that I was involved in the Republic of Georgia was very small. The war was only 5 days. We're only talking about a population of about 30,000. We had 96, I think, or 94 different aid agencies, government funders, UN agencies, ministry officials, 90 some odd different organizations all running around trying to coordinate with each other. When you look at something like the Haitian earthquake of 2010, you're not talking about 100 organizations. You're talking about 1,000 organizations, each of which is doing its own thing, none of which is controlled by a central planner. They coordinate with each other badly, if at all. The United Nations has a system for interagency coordination called the cluster system. And I always say it's a cluster something. System is not the word I would use. And literally they cannot coordinate the work. So what you get is, on the one hand, duplication of efforts or the delivery of aid that's radically inappropriate. With the population I was, they came streaming in with programs for children, but this population, because it had been affected by the collapse of the Soviet Union, most of the young people had left in search of work. And so it was a disproportionately elderly population. So they were getting, you know, toys and child-friendly spaces, and the people who were suffering were over 50. So you're getting inappropriate aid, you're getting duplication of aid, and you're getting huge gaps in aid. So one village gets cell phones, the next village gets nothing. One village gets plumbing, the next settlement gets nothing, or they get outhouses, or they expect someone to arrive and help them do something about sanitation, and they wait and they wait and they wait, and they're just on the cusp of doing something themselves when then an aid agency comes. So the aid agencies, because they're organizing around the project, they are doing a very bad job at letting displaced people know in a timely fashion what will happen to them. And once that kind of uncertainty has been introduced into the process, it's really hard for displaced people to use their own resources or coordinate their own efforts, because the minute they do so, the aid agencies rush in and mess everything up again. You know, one really good example of that was in a village I worked in called Hurvaletti, and it was one of the camps. And in Hurvaletti, they were waiting and waiting and waiting to find out if they would get plumbing. They didn't have running water. So they had these cinder block houses and no running water. So finally, everybody says, well, you know, we're going to have to grow food anyway. So they planted gardens in their yards, which is where their outhouses were. And then, of course, because they put pit outhouses into clay soil, which doesn't drain, the sewage came up and over, contaminating the food supply. And to come in and pump those outhouses out, you would have to destroy the gardens. Right? So it's this kind of thing that's happening all the time for displaced people, and it makes it simply impossible for them to get their feet underneath them and make any kind of plans for the future. And so they just sit in this eternal present, right? I mean, it's like Groundhog Day, if you can imagine Groundhog Day going on for 17 years.
You analyze this a little bit through the idea of the normal situation, right, that was shattered.
Yeah, and that's a technical term taken from the philosophy of Alain Badiou, who talks about the normal situation not as being a situation which is particularly peaceful or particularly violent or particularly any one way or another, but a situation in which most of the things in your daily experience are networked together in a stable arrangement. And this is the one thing that we constantly deprive displaced people of, the ability to know from day to day, more or less, what's going to happen. And that predictability, whether the situation that is built for them is productive and good or shitty and violent, if it's either one of those things, good or bad, it's at least predictable and you can act. But if it's constantly unstable, you're paralyzed. You sit there, I'm serious, for years, barely able to speak.
One of the other conclusions that you made with this book was that the systemic failure exposes a second goal. So their first goal, which is, you know, some kind of humanitarian aid, like keeping people alive, being useful, being helpful. And to some degree, they are. They're keeping people alive. But you said there's another goal, which is really protecting donor countries from the displaced.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that with the war in Syria, that it's become the overwhelming goal, which is to keep people trapped in both space and time, in order to prevent them from moving towards donor countries. And so what we're looking at is not a strategy that is what it claims to be, which is, according to the aid agencies, and especially UNHCR, about social reintegration. It's not about social reintegration. It's literally about offshoring people and keeping them distinct from the society that they've landed in so that they cannot move towards the donor countries. So we're thinking that we can somehow put displaced people on ice by putting them in camps or holding them now in countries which have been, whole countries which have been turned into camps. Like Greece is a giant camp. And we have this idea that offshoring is somehow a resolution to the problem. If only we can keep all the Syrians in Turkey. If only we could keep all the Sudanese in the Dadaab camp in Kenya and prevent them from moving towards Nairobi, that this is a solution. And I think one of the biggest arguments of the book, something I would argue passionately, is that this is not a solution at all. It's not a solution for displaced people. I mean, being held in limbo for decades, but it's not really a long-term solution for donor countries, because camps, when people are held in situations like this, this is how we find people becoming radicalized, becoming frustrated and angry and willing to sign on to any program that will promise them some movement forward.
You also suggested in the solution side that really we have to look at geopolitics.
Yeah, I think one of the very strange things about writing this book is that everyone asks me for solutions. There's something about the whole construction of a humanitarian project which demands solutions. And by that, I don't mean resolutions of the problem. I mean, they want technocratic solutions within the framework of an aid project. And this, the problems that we face now are not resolvable through humanitarian projects. The real issue is coming up with a new and better way of stabilizing conflict so that people aren't displaced in the first place, and or making peace so that they can go home and get back to their real lives or rebuild new lives once they've been returned. But the end resolution of the Syrian crisis is not to have better services in camps. The end resolution of the Syrian crisis is for the United States and Iran and Russia to stop fomenting war in Syria. And so I think when we think of this as a technocratic problem of aid, that is a deliberate attempt to move our gaze away from the root cause. And so I I know that it is simplistic to say, well, let's not have war. It is idealistic to say, let's have some kinds of international agreements around displacement and the management of displacement and displacement as a technique of war. That I know that is idealistic. And yet it is the only long-term stable resolution for this problem. And if you don't like that answer, then you should plan on another 100 million people being on the move in the next decade.
You know, it sounded like some of the people you interviewed actually said this as well.
Yeah, I think that it was very interesting to me that although most of the aid workers I talked to in Georgia were very focused on technocratic solutions within the framework of aid, the IDPs themselves that I spent a lot of time with were acutely aware that this was a geopolitical project, a geopolitical problem that could only be resolved geopolitically. And so they would, for example, they'd be offered, you know, women's peace building classes. And the women would say to me, like, what the hell do I need a peace building class for? I didn't start this war. Why don't you send Bush and Putin to a peace building class? And, you know, they were, in fact, correct, right? That this had been a war in Georgia between a U.S.-backed regime, the Saakashvili regime in Georgia, and a Russian-backed regime in South Ossetia, and that it was a crisis of regional and even global geopolitics that had almost nothing to do with them. So any intervention you're targeting at them is a misplaced intervention. And they knew that better than anybody. In fact, the most astute analyses of the problem at the level of global geopolitics I got were from IDPs themselves, who had lots and lots of time to watch the news.
The last thing I wanted you to respond to was that people were actually suffering more after the conflict than actually during the conflict. How can that be?
We tend to think about physical suffering in conflict as being related to the violence of war, right? So when you talk to Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, they are really good at dealing with gunshot wounds and machete hacking. There are many, many NGOs that come in to provide prostheses. I don't know why prostheses is the medical intervention of choice, but it often is. And so they're very good at acute care. But displacement is a chronic condition. So what happens to people is that the erosion of their health is happening in slow motion over a long period of time, and they're not receiving the kinds of medical treatment they need for chronic conditions related to displacement. So, for example, I will tell you that if you're on a World Food Program food package, most of the calories you are getting are from white carbohydrates, white rice, white bread, sugar. They get, you know, big quantities of sugar because those things are easy to move in and because it's a cheap way of meeting caloric goals. Okay, you know, if your displacement is 3 weeks, you're going to survive living on macaroni for 3 weeks. But the people I was with lived on 3 servings of macaroni a day, every day for almost 2 years. And not surprisingly, diabetes became a big problem. And many of the people I knew were struggling with to stabilize themselves because they had become diabetic. People who had been diabetic before were dying of their disease because they couldn't get enough treatment for it, and they certainly couldn't start to have a healthier diet. And yet there was no sort of recognition that medical care for displacement should involve the improvement of diet, right? Or should involve medication for hypertension, which was a big one where I was. Hypertension was not seen as a war-related condition, and yet is intrinsically a war-related condition for many of these people who are living under tremendous stress and who are not receiving anti-hypertensive drugs and can't afford to buy them themselves because they've lost their jobs, they've lost their land, they've lost their livelihoods. And so my friends were dying of strokes. And it was, you know, I followed the same group for almost 8 years. And it got to the point where every year I'd go back and I spent my whole summer at funeral after funeral after funeral. The rate at which people were dying was fantastic. And yet that was not conceived of as a war-related condition.
Well, Elizabeth Cullen Dunn, it has been a great pleasure to talk with you about this book, No Path Home. Really fascinating read, fascinating research. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
I am so excited. Thank you so much.
When we come back, how to build a sustainable and equitable food system. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next two guests have studied the food system and what it means to have a system that is equitable and sustainable. What are the problems in the system and what are the solutions? With us is Raj Patel. He is a research professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, The Value of Nothing, and The History of the World and Seven Cheap Things. He also co-hosts a fortnightly food politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Saru Jayaraman is also with us. She's the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include The Accidental American, Behind the Kitchen Door, and Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. Raj Patel and Saru Jayaraman are contributors to the Nation magazine's special issue, The Future of Food, Setting the Table for the Next Generation.
So welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us. You guys have done a special issue for the Nation magazine about just sustainable food systems. I thought we should start with what we're talking about. When we say just sustainable food systems, Raj Patel, what does that mean for you?
I think we're all sort of agreed that in order for something to be sustainable, it needs to be more than just a process of being able to get the food out of the ground reliably season after season. For it to be sustainable, we need to be talking both about ecological and social sustainability. You can't continue harvesting as we have while dependent on carbon being spewed into the atmosphere, destroying the possibility of future generations from being able to grow food. But similarly, you can't depend, as the food system does, on the exploitation of workers from farm to fork in order to be able to get your organic and locally grown food. So sustainability is necessarily both a social and an ecological term.
So then necessarily connected with a just food system.
That's right. So the idea of justice is, I think, one that's incredibly wide, right? I mean, when we think about justice, we need to be thinking not just about our present generation, as Saru's work just shows so magnificently, you know, treating workers properly right now, but also thinking about future generations, about what's fair to as yet unborn generations, but also thinking about the past, about atoning for the way that the food system now is built on centuries of slavery and colonialism.
Well, that's a perfect lead-in for Saru. Saru, why don't you tie history into this present day and where we are today as a result of this, how they're all connected?
You know, the existence of the food system in America relies on the labor of 20 million workers. One in six American workers works in food. It is by far the largest, collectively the largest private sector employment in the United States, and yet it is the lowest paying. In particular, within that group of 20 million, the vast majority, 12 million of those workers are restaurant workers alone. Forget the rest of the food system. Alone, the restaurant industry is the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy, and yet it is actually the restaurant industry is the absolute lowest paying employer in the U.S. Every year, the Department of Labor puts out a list of the 10 lowest paying jobs, and 7 of the 10 are restaurant jobs. And we've discovered that that really is due to the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which represents the Fortune 500 chains, and which, as it turns out, if you look back in history, really it's the predecessor forms of this trade lobby fought to be able to hire newly freed slaves post-emancipation and pay them a $0 wage and let them live on customer tips. And that idea was actually codified into law so that the first tipped workers in the United States were mostly Black. They were actually given a $0 wage from their employer and made to live on tips. And we went from a $0 wage in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour, the current federal minimum wage for tipped workers in the U.S. And it's between $2.13 and $7.50 in 43 states in the United States. It's an abysmal, ridiculous wage that it forces a mostly female workforce to live off tips and really, tolerate the absolute worst sexual harassment of any industry because they're having to feed their families on tips. These are not young workers. They're mostly in their mid-30s. 40% of them are single moms, and they're having to feed their families on the whims of customers who often mistreat them in various ways because they know they have that power. So really, when we talk about a just and sustainable food system, I think I would say two things. One, you cannot have sustainable food without sustainable wages and working conditions for the people who cook, prepare, and serve that food. And certainly, once we know that that whole system is a legacy of slavery and a source of sexual harassment, I don't understand how we could have a sustainable restaurant as we do in America, sustainable food restaurant that pays its workers $2 and $3 an hour. But that is a very common thing. Some of our favorite organic, local, and sustainable food restaurants pay $2 and $3 to their workers. But the second thing I really have to say is sustainable has another meaning to it, which is that sustainable means sustained, that it can go on, it can continue. And when 1 in 3 Americans at this moment works full-time or more than full-time and lives in poverty, and we're heading to, within 10 years, a moment in which 1 in 2 working Americans will work full-time and live in poverty, you cannot sustain any food system when half of the country cannot afford to eat or eat out, let alone have a sustainable food system sustained. So I don't know if that made sense, but there's just no way for this system to continue as it's continuing right now, unless we address the wages and working conditions of workers in the food system.
Before we go on to other types of food workers, and Raj, you wrote about some of these in your piece, particularly the banana workers. Saru, have you looked at the United States treatment of its restaurant workers, food workers, compared to other countries in similar situations? Is it unique in how poorly it treats its restaurant staff, for example?
Certainly, labor exploitation is not unique to the United States, but it must be understood that we quite often set the standards for the world. And particularly with the chains that are mostly based here and have formed this thing called the National Restaurant Association and have lately formed something called the Multinational Hospitality and Restaurant Association, the MHRA. And this idea of paying workers this ridiculously low wage definitely is a result of our unique racial caste system in the United States, of our legacy of slavery. And that now the MHRA is working actively to spread this idea of a lower wage for tipped workers in many other countries. They've been fighting for it in Canada. They've been fighting for it in other parts of the world. So we're not unique in the exploitation of food workers. We are unique in the sense that we set the standards, and certainly the major corporations that are driving this exploitation worldwide are based here and have won kind of these ridiculous wage agreements here and are trying to push that on the rest of the world.
Raj, you noted in your piece in The Nation about the other end of this, which is the production and what happened to banana workers in Central America, for example. Tell us how that ties into sustainable food systems and just food systems.
The idea here is that, for example, people are buying fair trade coffee and fair trade tea and fair trade bananas. And the idea there is that when you're buying fair trade, what you're doing is you hope giving workers just a little bit more, or giving farmers rather, a little bit more so that they can survive the very low commodity prices that are being imposed on them by these big multinationals. And so I buy fair trade coffee because, you know, what's the alternative? You know, bastard coffee, the kind of coffee that involves the exploitation of children because I like my coffee bitter. No, you buy fair trade. But the problem is not in the idea that people oughtn't to be able to survive. The problem is twofold. On the one hand, this is a very unilateral move. It's a sort of pennies, you know, sort of crumbs from the table from us, a sort of small token of recognition that we feel a little bit guilty that people are in general in conditions of extreme exploitation. But the deeper problem is that we never stop to think about why it is that large parts of Central America are the United States fruit bowl. How is it that we're okay with the conversion of land in large parts of the world to suit us? And you know, some people say, well, you know, what, if we don't buy their bananas, what will they do? Poor things. And of course, that's an utterly rubbish argument. I mean, it's to paper over the fact that it took violence and state power from the United States to make it possible for the United Fruit Company, a company that was known locally as El Pulpo, the octopus, for its tentacles into various sort of houses of power, to be able to establish itself in the Caribbean. And you know, today we have the vestiges of that history when we think about terms like banana republic. You know, when we say that some place is a banana republic, what we sometimes mean is the idea that you know, although it has the nominal sort of view of being a democracy, in fact, you know, it's a general who's in charge and he's our man and he's, you know, he's a company man. And the idea of banana republics emerges because the United Fruit Company paid and made sure that the kinds of people who were in charge of these countries were ones who didn't want things like land reform. And so when a democratically elected president started to find that there were some bits of the banana plantations that weren't being used, and he said, look, we'll buy them from you and we'll redistribute them to the poor, the United Fruit Company was so alarmed that they called John Foster Dulles at the CIA, and the CIA ignited a coup that then resulted in a civil war in which 250,000 people were killed. That you don't get from fair trade. Acknowledging that history, you don't get from fair trade. And that, as I was saying, right now the US is pushing these heinous trade agreements on other countries. Before, the US has been doing similar things by just forcing US companies on and US governance on large parts of the Caribbean. And that question is a much trickier one to address when we think about the US culpability here, because really the answer is that we ought to be paying the countries that we have in many ways turned to our convenience and in the process killed hundreds of thousands. We ought to be paying reparation.
You mentioned the trade agreements right now and how harmful they are, given what the United States has now with Donald Trump at the helm, trying to or promising to dismantle these trade agreements. Is that something that should be done?
If you're asking me, Maria, I think absolutely that the international peasant movement, La Via Campesina, is very keen on taking agriculture out of the World Trade Organization and out of NAFTA. NAFTA was explicitly aimed at kicking Mexican peasants off their land so that large-scale agriculture could produce cheap food to then sell to the United States. But removing, you know, the U.S. from NAFTA does nothing to redistribute the land that was taken from these peasants. So, you know, without that concomitant kind of redistribution of land back to the poor, getting out of a trade agreement, and particularly the way that Trump's going to do it, is a half measure that has the possibility of leaving poor people worse off. I certainly think it's a good idea for countries to be able to have sovereignty in a way that trade agreements deny them. But the way that Trump is doing it, of course, is as part of a sort of xenophobic plan, not to be able to redistribute goods to the poor, but in order for the richest corporations in this country to be able to have their way on new and newly renegotiated terms.
So much of what the two of you are talking about really ties back into these very large publicly traded corporations and the power that they have. So then the question becomes, you know, how do you deal with these really large international, multinational corporations that wield so much power? Saru, what do you think?
Yeah. You fight them. You know, like, we are an organization that has been up against one of the most powerful trade lobbies, I would say, in the world. the National Restaurant Association. It's been named one of the top 10 lobbying groups in Congress. We call it the other NRA because most people know about the Rifle Association, but just don't know how powerful the Restaurant Association is on a lot of different issues. And, you know, we're not a huge group. We started as a little scrappy group just 15 years ago, and over the last 15 years have organized and fought and exposed them in so many ways that they have felt threatened enough to attack us. So, I mean, they've spent at this point over $10 million trying to shut us down, from lawsuits to congressional investigations, going after our funders, going after our tax exempt status, going after me personally, putting my children's pictures up on their attack website. I mean, they will do anything to stop workers from demanding their rights or asking for more than the $2 and $3 that they are lobbying. You know, they've lobbied so well to keep wages at. And so we need to expose trade lobbies and huge corporations and their activities. We need to fight against them. And we really, mostly, especially need to be holding accountable elected officials in both parties that have rolled over to really facilitate the power of these huge corporations. You know, unfortunately, in our case, we've seen elected officials in both parties kowtow to the Restaurant Association because they fund their campaigns and because they know they'll attack hard if they don't do everything that they want. And so we, the people, need to be showing our support to electeds that stand up to the Restaurant Association and Big Ag and large corporations, and also holding accountable any electeds that don't do that. And that's the only way that we're going to actually have a true democracy rather than a nation controlled completely by corporate kleptocrats.
Raj Patel, what would you say to that?
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we have the storm about Harvey Weinstein, for example. And, you know, one of the things that Saru's research has shown is the way in which, the structure of low wages and tipped work and the forum of the restaurant as it is, it is the perfect cocktail for sexual assaults to be happening. For elected officials to be condoning that, you know, to be condoning the enabling environment of a million Harvey Weinsteins is the sort of shame that we ought to be bringing to their door right now.
Yeah, I imagine that's tough, given that the president of the United States is, for lack of a better term, the groper in chief.
But I do think that while perhaps our president cannot feel the emotion of shame, that there are ways in which the elected officials who side with the National Restaurant Association can be made to pay a very high political cost.
And I just want to chime in that the reason we have a president who's a groper in chief is because you have millions of working people across America that feel completely disgusted, disillusioned, and disengaged with the political system precisely because they see elected officials rolling over to right. corporate interests. So, so many people talk about, oh, people voted for Trump. I mean, the truth everybody knows is most people in America did not vote in this election. And it was like the lowest turnout ever. And I know from our population of 12 million restaurant workers, it's because they feel just totally turned off by the powers that be and the way in which they kowtow to the Restaurant Association. So, rather, there's such an inclination, among elites, I would say even in the food movement, in quotes, to want to be somewhat centrist and not be too bold or too progressive. And I actually think that is the wrong intuition. The intuition should be, we should be listening, especially to working people in this moment that income inequality has reached its climax, its zenith in the United States. We need to be listening to working people and showing them that we will deliver for them in order to not have a Trump get elected. And that's what we haven't done. And I do want to bring up one thing that I brought up in the Nation piece that's a really good example of how the National Restaurant Association is now wielding its power and what working people can do and everybody can do. You know, the Restaurant Association has gotten together with President Trump and his Department of Labor to announce new proposed regulation that's already been submitted to the White House that any restaurant that pays a worker a full minimum wage in this country, that's $7.25 an hour, gets to wholly and legally steal its workers' tips, keep its workers' tips. Meaning a restaurant can charge you, give you a bill and you pay a tip and you think it's going to the worker, but now legally with Trump's new rule, the boss can take that tip that you gave thinking it's going to the workers and go buy a Mercedes. I mean, that is what is being proposed. It's going to be submitted to the White House for review. It will come up for public comment later this year, early next year. It's already been made law in the 10th Circuit. It is outrageous. It should outrage anybody. You know, it overturns 80 years of law saying that tips are the property of workers. It should outrage workers, of course, but it should outrage consumers because it's consumer fraud. And it's just another example of collusion between corporate America and just complete control of our democracy. And so we need people to stand up and speak out and say, absolutely not. We don't want our tips going to the boss. And that is, again, Democrats or others who stand up and say that is wrong, I think will find that they are going to have a lot more support than those that just roll over and let the Restaurant Association or other corporations do their bidding.
In some of the jurisdictions in the U.S. where you've seen the minimum wage go up to, say, $15 an hour, and I think there have been a handful of those, have they included restaurant workers in this or have they excluded them?
Only 7 states have included restaurant workers. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska got rid of this legacy of slavery, this lower wage for tipped workers. In California, it's been 50 years since they got rid of this. In the other 43 states, including New York and Washington, D.C. and Massachusetts, every time the wage has gone up, including the new efforts to go to 15. So in New York and D.C., 15 was passed. But in all of those states, tipped workers were left out or even saw their workers decline, their wages decline. And so what you essentially have is legislation that raises wages for everybody except the poorest women in the state. They're throwing the poorest women under the bus every time they raise the minimum wage. And again, it's due to the power of the Restaurant Association and its control even over Democrats who move these minimum wage bills, who then the Democrats, we need to give the Restaurant Association its exemption so that their workers are not covered by this $15. And that is precisely why we as people need to be holding those elected officials accountable.
With regards to the future of food, what is it we're facing with farming, ownership, diseases that are happening on the farms, climate that is making food security heightened? What are we facing in terms of food sustainability?
If we're thinking just in terms of climate change, then we're already heading towards a rather perilous situation in which productivity is destined to fall in the United States. And that's without even thinking about the rise of certain kinds of weed resistance and the certain kinds of transformations in U.S. ecology that makes it inevitable that farms will be less productive here. But of course, the people who are worst hit by this are the people who have nothing to do with climate change. If you look at the map of the most vulnerable populations around the world. It's folk in sub-Saharan Africa, in Southeast Asia and South Asia, whose contribution to climate change has been utterly minimal and who will nonetheless be the climate refugees, and climate refugees have already started to cross borders, but who will be the people who suffer the hardest while we are relatively insulated with the wealth that we've accumulated through centuries of being able to burn as much carbon as we like. So the long-term outlook in terms of climate alone is one that bends towards injustice. And again, you know, that will mean to some extent food price hikes, and that will ripple through the United States because, as Saru was saying, with so many people in the United States already food insecure, we're at 50 million at the moment, and with so many people who are working poor in the United States, the inequalities that climate change is already foisting on the world and which will be felt much worse outside this country will also be felt here. And again, it's through the structure of social inequality in the United States that the horrors of climate change will be magnified and unequally distributed. And one could say the same thing about the dangerous state of meat production, for example. And another thing that's happening in the Trump administration is that the National Chicken Council is looking to speed up line speeds for workers who are involved in chicken processing, to raise the number of chickens passing inspectors to 160, 180 birds per minute. And it's almost certain that at those higher speeds, as we've seen in other parts of the world, when you increase line speeds that way, diseases thrive and pass inspectors by. And that doesn't augur well for the food system either. And again, you know, the diseases that propagate through the food system are made worse by the kinds of things that the Restaurant Opportunity Center has observed, where, you know, if you're being paid very little, you have no healthcare and you have to work, then you'll go to work even if you're sick, and you'll go to work if you're sick with H1N1. And the food system becomes a more dangerous and toxic place because of the inequality foisted by these large corporations.
You had also said at another interview about the sixth extinction we're all facing, that it's human demand for meat that's really driving a lot of this extinction. Can you tie that together for us?
Sure. Let's take the example of chicken. The original chicken, it comes from Southeast Asia, from the jungles of Southeast Asia. That bird and the indigenous people used to rely on it have been not rendered extinct, but 50% of the original chicken species are now extinct. Instead, we have government breeding programs that now have chickens that are bred with breasts that are so large that they can't walk. In order to be able to fund and feed these animals, large parts of the world fall under the plow. And so that means the Brazilian Cerrado, a very dynamic ecosystem, gets converted into monocultural soy farming. And when you clear these habitats and you replace it by monoculture, you render species extinct. The demand for meat, again, is linked and requires fuel and investment and the transformation of large parts of the planet's surface. And the industrialization, the industrial meat production system, requires that there are just two or three species that interact that bring us our whatever it is. And the consequence of that is that there's less and less room on the planet for biodiversity. And so certainly the consumption of meat is very much linked to transformations in habitat. And certainly the industrial massive sort of meatification of the world's diet is linked to species extinction in a very deep way.
You know, the last thing I would like to cover has to do with the automation of both the farming industry and the food service industry. So I happened to notice a restaurant when I was in Washington, D.C., in which there were no food workers, in which you go in and you press some buttons and you order your food and a machine prepares it, and you look up on the wall and it tells you which slot from which you pull your food out. There was one in the airport, it might have been Athens, in which similarly, no food workers. They set up iPads, you order your food through the iPad, you say what to hold, what you want, you pay through the iPad, and that's done. There was an article in a newspaper recently in which farms are now being automated to that degree. What do we see in our future here? Saru, why don't you start on that?
This is a favorite argument of the National Restaurant Association. They love to say that if you raise wages, we'll just automate, you know, everything and replace restaurant workers with robots. And in the restaurant industry, at least, which, as I mentioned, is the largest and fastest growing sector of the food system, but also the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of the entire U.S. economy, that is simply not true. Automation is not replacing jobs in the restaurant industry. In fact, the regions where we've seen the greatest automation in the restaurant industry, we've seen actually the fastest job growth. So in our industry, people generally actually go to restaurants because they want to be served by human beings. And it has not actually happened that automation has replaced jobs. In many ways, actually, automation has actually just increased jobs, because the restaurants that are not automated continue to have workers. And then the automated restaurants, nobody's actually fully automated. There are always workers involved somehow in an automated restaurant. And so those are additional jobs. So our industry just continues to explode. There's absolutely no indication that that will decline anytime soon. And what that points to is the fact that what we really need is to increase wages. The industry is actually going through the worst labor shortage in the history of the industry, because workers simply cannot afford to stay in one place. Employers are dying to find, attract, and retain workers. And so they're having to figure out that we have so many high road restaurants that have joined our association and they're calling for higher wages in the industry, because everybody on the leading edge of the industry is beginning to realize this business model is just not sustainable. We can't keep workers. And really, again, the future of the food system depends on changing this business model so that the industry can continue, and frankly, the nation's economy can survive, and that there is a food system, because there won't be when half, as I said, half the country can't afford to eat.
Raj Patel, anything you would add to that?
Well, I mean, the stretch for automation in the fields is sort of the extension of the transformation of farmers as botanists and as experimenters into farmers as technical kind of chemistry managers and robot maintainers. It involves, to some extent, the de-skilling of what it is to be nurturing life and to be connected to life, and instead a transformation towards turning fields into these fully automated factories. I think that particularly if we're interested in surviving the sixth extinction and the surviving climate change, what we need is diversification. And the knowledge of people who are tending these living beings in the fields needs to be recognized, and the wages there need to be raised as well. So rather than solve the labor shortage that we're seeing also in the fields right now, and again, this is a sort of a corollary of the sort of Trump immigration issues, but the labor shortages in the fields are being purported at some level to be solved by bringing robots into the fields. But all you're doing is consolidating a monocultural agricultural system that can't survive, just can't survive, as we're seeing with these extreme weather events around the country. Monocultures are really bad at surviving extreme weather events, but diversified farming systems are much better. Diversified farming systems require skill and labor, and well-paid labor at that. And moving away from the disaster of monoculture towards a system that recognizes and values skilled labor, I think, is tremendously important. But to fight that, you have to fight the chemistry industry, and that's a story for another time.
Let me thank you both for your time, for your research, and for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Raj Patel is a research professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, The Value of Nothing, and The History of the World and Seven Cheap Things. He also co-hosts a fortnightly food politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Saru Jayaraman is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include The Accidental American, Behind the Kitchen Door, and Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. Raj Patel and Saru Jayaraman are contributors to The Nation magazine's special issue, The Future of Food, Setting the Table for the Next Generation.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin,
Anais Amin,
Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.